Please stand by. We're about to begin. Good day and welcome, everyone, to the Trust for America's Health Ready or Not conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to John Auerbach. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you, and good morning. I'm John Auerbach, the President and CEO of Trust for America's Health, or TFHA. Thanks for joining us today for the release of Ready or Not, Protecting the Public from Diseases, Disasters, and Bioterrorism. We started releasing Ready or Not in 2003 in response to needing to advance preparedness for public health emergencies in the wake of 9/11 and the anthrax tragedies. Those events were a wake-up call that the nation needed to modernize and rethink how the country prepared and responded to disease outbreaks and natural disasters. I'm pleased this morning to be joined by Dr. Karen Remley, who is the CEO of the American Academy of Pediatrics, as well as a former Commissioner of Health for the Commonwealth of Virginia. In that role, Dr. Remley oversaw public health preparedness among her broad portfolio of public health issues. In addition, we're joined by Dr. Celeste Phillip, who is the Surgeon General and Secretary of the Florida Department of Health. Dr. Phillips knows firsthand what it takes to prepare for and respond to large-scale public health emergencies. She and her department have done an outstanding job this year in responding to the emergencies related to hurricanes, as they did last year in responding to Zika and other weather-related emergencies. I'll start the call off with an overview of the report, and then I'll hand things over to Drs. Remley and Dr. Phillips. And then I'll close with some top-level recommendations. The report we're releasing today was supported by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and it's available on TFHA's website at www.healthyamericans.org. State-level scores and results for the specific indicator areas are available on that site, and also our staff are available to help answer questions and provide any additional information that you might need. During the 16 years since 9/11, we've seen dramatic changes and progress all across the country. The public health sector in general and the state public health departments in particular have done an outstanding job. We've seen the evidence of that this year in the robust and impressive activities by the public health departments in Texas and Florida in response to hurricanes, and by California in response to the wildfires. But public health departments have often lacked the resources they needed to respond, at times facing declining funding at the federal, state, and local levels. And there are certain areas of preparedness which have not been adequately addressed. Several of the areas needing attention are not within the control of the public health sector at all, but in fact require broader legislative or regulatory decision-making. Bottom line is, we need to pay attention to strengthening our public health preparedness efforts. Last year, the focus was on Zika. This year, the focus is on weather-related emergencies. There's no predicting what the next emergency will be that public health departments must respond to. And at the same time, these very health departments not only have to address public health emergencies, but they also have to manage responses to the opioid epidemic, related rises in HIV and hepatitis C, foodborne illness outbreaks, resurgences in some areas of measles, mumps, and whooping cough, Zika becoming endemic, and a host of other challenges. What we keep seeing, however, is that despite the frequency of health threats, the nation has done an inconsistent approach to preparing for them. According to our analysis, federal funding to support the base level of preparedness to support state and local and healthcare capabilities has been cut by more than half since 2002. The Ready or Not report provides an overview of health security issues and policies, and this includes featuring a state-by-state review of 10 key indicators of preparedness. Each year, we prepare 10 key indicators to assess health emergency preparedness capabilities in states. These indicators reflect some important areas of preparedness, including some newly emerging ones. The indicators represent a snapshot of certain areas of health emergency preparedness for that year, and they're developed in consultation with leading public health experts based upon data from publicly available sources or information provided by public officials. Our report is not a comprehensive analysis. Some of the states, lacking several of the measured indicators, have nonetheless done a very good job of protecting the public. However, we believe that the report is necessary in order to provide the public with a better understanding of how well prepared states and their communities are to respond to public health emergencies. The scores themselves are not intended to serve as a reflection on the performance of officials at specific state or local health departments. They reflect instead a much broader context, as I said, including resources, policy environments, and the health status of a community. This year, we found that 25 states scored a 5 or lower on 10 key indicators of health security preparedness. And I'll quickly go over the key indicators and just to remind everyone that state-level information is available on our website. So, on to the indicators. 19 states and Washington, D.C. increase or maintain their public health budgets from 2015-16 to 2016-17. While federal support is essential for maintaining preparedness capabilities, state funding for public health also ensures ongoing and underlying systems for all public health needs. Secondly, 33 states increased their overall preparedness score on the National Health Security Preparedness Index between 2016 and 17. This is a composite review of more than 100 measures that relate to public health preparedness. While a majority of states did have increased scores this year, the average score was 6.8 out of 10 on the scale. Number three, 30 states and Washington, D.C. have accredited state public health departments, which demonstrate their capability to meet core public health functions. Next, in 20 states and Washington, D.C., 70% or more of the hospitals report meeting core elements of the antibiotic stewardship program in 2016. That's according to information reported to CDC. And that's been an important program in reducing overprescribing as well as healthcare-associated and antibiotic-resistant infections. Next, at least half of the population in each of the states was vaccinated against seasonal flu. The CDC goal is, in fact, 70% of the population above 6 months years of age should be vaccinated, and this helps to show general vaccination preparedness. Of a new disease outbreak. Next, 26 states participated in the Enhanced Nurse Licensure Compact to support healthcare response preparedness. And that ensures that nurses are licensed to be able to practice in additional states, which is helpful in cases of emergencies where nurses have to go from one state to another in order to provide what is known as surge capacity or support. Next, 14 states have joined the United States Climate Alliance, a bipartisan coalition of states committed to reducing greenhouse gas emissions consistent with the goals of the Paris Agreement. This is viewed by many as an important step to help mitigate health and other adverse climate-related impacts. We had two indicators from the annual Association of Public Health Laboratories annual survey. It found that 47 states and Washington, D.C.'s laboratory directors reported that they provided biosafety training and/or provided information about biosafety training courses. And the same number reported having a biosafety professional on staff. And finally, 8 states and Washington, D.C. have paid sick leave laws, which are obviously important for helping reduce the spread of infectious disease. Beyond the indicators, I also want to note that the report includes several expert commentaries, including one from Dr. Phillip. These are from public health officials who share their perspectives on and experiences with the historic hurricanes, wildfires, and other events of 2017, including representatives from California, Florida, Louisiana, and Texas. Now, let me turn things over to Dr. Karen Remley, who will talk about key health security concerns facing the nation today. Dr. Remley?
Thank you. This is Karen Remley, and I thank John for that excellent summary. I think some of you may wonder why the American Academy of Pediatrics, but what I would say to all of you is children are our future, and in any disaster or event, taking care of children, those who are the most beloved and most vulnerable for the entire population, is something that makes a huge difference in a community's resiliency and ability to move forward. So this report does document our nation's inconsistent approach to preparing for health emergencies, which can mean we are often caught off guard when new threats arise, whether it's a major hurricane, an emerging infectious disease like Zika, or a bioterrorist threat. And then in order to be able to respond, we end up diverting attention and resources away from serious ongoing public health priorities to those emergencies. As a pediatrician and as a former commissioner of health who served during the H1N1 outbreak and through multiple hurricanes, I can tell you that investing in preparedness well before disaster strikes makes a real difference, and especially for infants and children who are critically dependent on other people to take care of them. Unfortunately, instead, all too often, we find ourselves doing the opposite. After the sense of emergency dissipates, so does our attention to it. The mundane gets in the way of what happens. Sustained cuts to public health funding and the public health workforce perpetuate that cycle. These cuts disrupt critical infrastructure needed for response. The nation's disease command and control centers, public health laboratories, the strategic national stockpile, and other key functions. As a pediatrician, I also want to raise an essential but often overlooked factor of our nation's preparedness planning. How are we protecting our children? To be truly prepared to respond to disasters and be resilient in their wake, children's needs must be integrated into all levels of preparedness, planning, and recovery. Too often, they are an afterthought, and there is not adequate funding to focus, to prioritize, or even address the unique considerations and vulnerabilities of children. As we've seen in Puerto Rico and U.S. Virgin Islands, children's unique health care needs range from the routine, such as immunizations, well-child checkups, and developmental screenings that continue after a disaster occurs, to those that are life-threatening, such as babies who are born premature and in need of higher levels of care. Planning for how the range of health care needs for children are going to be met is essential. And when disaster strikes, children's health care providers, like pediatricians, are an essential component of the response and long-term recovery and resilience of communities. Every family, especially those with children, should have a preparedness plan in place. Every child care center, school, and school district must also have emergency plans in place. And all caregivers should be trained in how to respond to emergencies. These plans need to be practiced and regularly updated, and they must include how to make sure children are protected, that there are channels for emergency communications with families, and how to safely and quickly reunify children with their family when the emergency is over. At the American Academy of Pediatrics, we have recommended a review of all federal public health preparedness policies and programs to ensure they prioritize and meet the needs of children. And we have called for performance measures for hospital and state and local preparedness efforts to increase accountability for meeting those objectives. We have also called for closing the gaps in medical countermeasures for children. Medical countermeasures include vaccinations, antiviral medication, and other medications that are used to treat the effects of a man-made disaster or infectious disease outbreak. However, many of these have only been approved for use in adults, or they lack an appropriate delivery device, such as an auto-injector or a liquid form that could be used in children by an emergency responder who is not likely to have any pediatric medical training. So the nation's stockpiles and recommended responses to outbreaks or acts of bioterrorism are ill-prepared to address the needs of those we care the most about, our children. We can fix this disparity, but it will require investment, the government must support the research, development, and procurement of pediatric medical countermeasures and consider safety and dosing information and the needs of children. We must also ensure there is pediatric equipment available in the national stockpile. For instance, having child-appropriate ventilators and other devices readily and rapidly available can mean the difference of life and death during emergencies, particularly since children are more likely to be impacted quickly by a bioterrorism event. If you think about their very small size and how close they are to the ground, their physiological differences, they breathe faster, they have thinner skin, they're more likely to be exposed, and the fact that they are also likely to be separated from their parent or caregiver. And then I went with it, in another key aspect of preparedness is certainly prevention. Part of preventing the spread of infectious disease is to ensure that all children receive all of their recommended immunizations and receive them based on the recent schedule, the recommended schedule through the AAP and the CDC. We have had recent outbreaks of measles, mumps, and whooping cough in a number of communities, and they are startling, and it understands the growing need to better educate parents and individuals about vaccine safety. Many young pediatricians enter the workforce today, unlike me, having never seen measles or have even seen the after effects of polio. And now they're having to learn from those who witnessed the toll it took on children why we have the vaccine and the importance of delivering that. At AAP, we reiterate the simple truth that vaccines are safe, vaccines are effective, and vaccines save lives. Engaging in ongoing education about the value and safety of vaccines now will also help better support our communities when rapid mass vaccination campaigns may be necessary in the event of a new major disease outbreak or a bioterrorism threat. I want to reinforce in closing that if a community is prepared to meet the needs of a child during a disaster, that community will be more resilient. If they are not prepared to meet the needs of children during that disaster, then we as a nation cannot say we are prepared because they are our future. And I will turn the call back over to John.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Remley. Now let me introduce Dr. Phillip, the Surgeon General from Florida, to provide a frontline perspective on what it takes to keep people safe during a public health emergency. Dr. Phillip.
Thank you, John, for allowing me to provide some insights from our experience this past hurricane season, which was truly historic for us. Based on our past experiences, I think we weathered it, no pun intended, relatively well in Florida. I'd like to mention a couple of key points before I get into specifics from this past season. Preparedness and response are driven by local leadership, personnel, and assets. This is a very key concept in how we approach preparedness in Florida. The local folks are the experts on the ground who have situational awareness and know their community. The Department of Health in Florida includes a central office in Tallahassee, which oversees statewide operations and public health programs, regional program offices, and 67 county health departments. We have health departments in every county in our state that are part of our integrated state health department. This established integration allows for improved information flow during disaster response, as crucial relationships are already established and utilized on a regular basis. Each county health department, in turn, works with their county emergency management to prepare for and respond to local needs. The state only steps in if a county emergency operations center requests our assistance. During a major event, we are often also shoulder to shoulder with federal partners, including leaders from HHS, ASPR, and FEMA, who help to coordinate any requests we make for federal assistance. As such, federal investment is critical for building the public health infrastructure we need that has the capacity to prepare for and recover from weather and whatever other hazardous situations or emerging threats arise. It should be noted that when states are better prepared to respond, requests for federal assistance could be lessened. During emergencies, the Florida Department of Health, who is the lead agency for Emergency Support Function, or ESF-8, Health and Medical, along with other ESF-8 partners, coordinate staffing of special needs shelters, supports patient evacuation and then reentry back into those facilities, ensures the safety of food and drugs, provides critical incident stress debriefings and disaster behavioral health services, and conducts situationally appropriate surveillance. And that surveillance will depend on the nature of the response. We also disseminate tailored, timely public health messaging. During Hurricane Irma, this included reminders to use generators appropriately to prevent carbon monoxide poisoning, and using caution post-storm to avoid injury during cleanup. The department also administers two federal preparedness grants to build local capacity within the public health and healthcare community statewide. The Public Health Emergency Preparedness, or PHEP grant, supports all 67 county health departments and public health labs in developing community preparedness, epidemiological surveillance and investigation, and medical countermeasure delivery. The Hospital Preparedness Program funds 10 healthcare coalitions, and each county belongs to one of these 10 coalitions. And the purpose is to build capabilities for medical surge, continuity of healthcare delivery, and preparedness partnerships amongst the local healthcare partners. So what did this look like during Hurricane Irma? Hurricane Irma posed a unique challenge because the track was very unpredictable, meaning that more healthcare facilities decided to evacuate and more residents with special needs decided to shelter than we initially predicted. The storm at some points was 500 miles wide, which exceeded the width of our state. This meant that personnel could not be moved around in advance of the storm with ease, and as the track changed, this made it even more challenging, as counties who maybe were not initially expected to be in the path now found themselves in that position. Resources from other states, federal, and contracted assets were mobilized to support sheltering operations, but some counties did not receive additional staff until after the storm passed and it was safe to travel. Because of the surge in last-minute registrations to special needs shelters, comprehensive planning and placement for each registrant could not be completed prior to the storm, resulting in many of the shelters caring for clients with medical needs that maybe exceeded the shelter's level of care capacity. In total, ESF-8 assisted with 76 patient movement missions that supported the transport of hospital, skilled nursing facility, and assisted living facility clients. The department operated 113 special needs shelters during Irma, conducted more than 1,000 post-impact facility inspections, and performed more than 2,600 tests of public and private water systems. These are just a few highlights of ESA's activities and doesn't begin to describe local efforts and the actions of many other departments and agencies involved in Florida's response. As you can imagine, the operation was all-encompassing. But in reality, preparing to respond for any number of scenarios is a year-round activity that I think you heard very clearly from Dr. Remley needs to be emphasized. And while it doesn't always receive the spotlight, it is absolutely vital for saving lives for vulnerable populations, including children and older adults. No matter how successful a response is, there are always lessons learned. The first recommendation I'd like to touch on relates to one of the indicators in the report, which speaks to the need for better coordination of credentialing of all healthcare professionals, not just nurses, between states during an emergency. This would be enormously helpful for providers who evacuate with their patients to help care for them in other states, which we saw a lot of during our response to Irma. And for states that are not operating under an emergency declaration, much of the waivers associated with licensure and credentialing are not waived in those receiving jurisdictions, so this is something that we've identified as an opportunity for improvement in the future. Also, a federal system that allows for tracking of deployed assets could improve situational awareness and real-time decision-making. But to adjust for ever-changing circumstances, streamlined and flexible funding would allow for nimble responses as needed and greatly enhance public health's ability to be effective. That recommendation speaks a bit more to our experience in Florida last year with our efforts to control and combat the Zika virus in our state. Moving forward, we recognize the need to anticipate future storms that may impact much or all of the state. a scenario that I don't think we've contemplated much prior to Hurricane Irma. For our Department of Health, statewide emergency response efforts could be bolstered by improving planning for our special needs residents. And I think, as Dr. Remley indicated, working more closely with medical homes, health plans, these are some discussions that have already begun here. And I think we've also seen that the use of telehealth modalities might be an option in the future for providing consultation within some of these shelters, and that's something else that we'll be looking at. We also will be reevaluating our training for our staff that work in special needs shelters, and also trying to increase collaboration with other state agencies and private sector to support Floridians with special needs. I will end by thanking our federal partners and volunteers from other states. Without their help, we would not have been able to reach out and provide all the support needed for our residents. With the close succession of Hurricanes Harvey, Irma, and Maria, and now wildfires that unfortunately are still continuing in California, I know that federal response agencies have had to sustain their efforts across time and location, and we certainly have benefited immensely from their efforts, and thank you for their support. Thank you. I'll turn it back over to you, John.
Thank you very much, Dr. Phillip. I'll quickly go over some additional key recommendations in this year's report, and then we're going to open up the call for questions. First, as Dr. Remley said so well, communities must be adequately funded to be able to maintain a key set of baseline capabilities. Cuts and inconsistent funding can often threaten the ability to consistently maintain some very core types of protections. We need to ensure stable, sufficient funding for health security and public health preparedness. And I want to also raise that we believe there is a need to support a standalone, complementary public health emergency fund, which can be used for immediate surge funding when major new disasters or outbreaks occur. This type of funding must supplement, and it cannot supplant or take the place of, the essential core ongoing preparedness capabilities. The country must place a high priority on innovating and modernizing public health infrastructure as part of the preparedness effort. And this includes continuing to upgrade science and technology to keep up with advancements. Unfortunately, too often our public health capabilities are lagging behind what's new and essential now technologically. We need to continue to improve and support the ability of the healthcare system and hospitals to respond to major events, such as mass event outbreaks and disasters, and to new emerging threats. We need to work to mitigate and prevent the negative health consequences of climate and weather-related threats. We must prioritize addressing one of the most serious threats to human health by expanding efforts to stop superbugs and antibiotic resistance. We must continue to support the research and development of additional medical countermeasures, including new vaccines and medicines. And we must improve the rates of vaccinations for children and adults, since this is one of the most effective public health tools we have in fighting against many infectious diseases. In some important ways, the most important and far-reaching of our recommendation is that we must support a culture of resilience, so all communities are better prepared to cope with and recover from emergencies, particularly focusing on those who are most vulnerable. Sometimes the aftermath of an emergency situation may be more harmful than the initial event. This must also include support for local organizations and small businesses to prepare for and respond to emergencies. And you'll see within our report, there is an essay by a behavioral health specialist in Texas who looks at these particular needs related to resiliency as they play themselves out in the response to the Texas hurricane this year. To conclude, I just want to say that each year we experience new emergencies that test and stretch our workforce and communities. The severity of these emergencies may wax and wane, but there are always challenges, and they'll always continue to emerge. Public health professionals do a great job in the face of the challenge, particularly since they don't have consistent and sufficient support and resources. But we shouldn't have to make trade-offs when it comes to protecting our health and safety. With that, let's go up ahead now and open up the call for any questions. And just as a reminder, the report and the state-by-state materials that we've been referring to are available on our website. And again, that website's address is www.healthyamericans.org. So now, operator, we'd like to open up the call for questions.
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star one on your touchtone telephone. And as a reminder, if you are using a speakerphone today, please make sure that your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Once again, that's star one if you'd like to signal for a question at this time. We'll pause for just a moment to allow everyone an opportunity to signal. And our first question today comes from Andrew Siddons of Congressional Quarterly.
Hi, thank you so much for doing this call. This report comes as the Congress is about to potentially pass an $80 billion emergency supplemental after, I think, two others that are about $50 billion. Obviously, there will be the need for emergency supplemental spending depending on the situation, but do you have a sense of what kind of upfront investments ought to be made that could they reduce the size of the emergency spending, you know, necessary of this scale? Thank you.
Well, thank you for this is John Auerbach, and thank you for raising that issue. I would say that we actually welcome the next stage of disaster relief that you were just referring to, and in particular, that's the potential for the passage of an $80 billion emergency bill for recovery from the hurricanes and wildfires. I would point out there that very importantly, part of that $81 billion is a $200 million that would go to CDC, most of which would then be distributed to the states and the locals for the types of responses that we've been highlighting within this discussion. We do feel that it is possible to increase the availability of both core funding for emergency preparedness and to create a separate emergency public health emergency fund that would be available pre-approved by Congress so that in the event of an emergency there would be ready and timely access to those funds. We believe, though, that in terms of both approaches, reinforcing and strengthening the core funding, which, as I've mentioned, has been cut by about 50% over the last several years, and in addition to that, creating an emergency fund, both are necessary in order to prevent the kind of post-emergency response where we scramble for the necessary resources, lose time, and during that time period, potentially see injuries and illnesses and even deaths that could have been prevented. So both increasing our core public health support and creating that emergency fund would be necessary steps.
Thank you.
And again, that's star one to signal for a question, and we'll go next to Gary Evans of Hospital Infection Control.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my question. This is for Dr. Phillip. I apologize if this was mentioned a little bit earlier. I called in a little late to the meeting. But my question is, the CDC is reporting that the epicenter of the Zika outbreak in South America has pretty much been quelled, but they're predicting kind of an ongoing endemic presence. And I was just wondering, Dr. Phillip, since you were one of the few states that had actual cases of Zika, what you are doing to stay vigilant for the return of this vector-borne disease, and if you think that vigilance is important.
Absolutely, vigilance is important, and that is our driving theme as we continue to closely monitor activity throughout our state, but in particular in South Florida, where we saw active transmission through mosquitoes last year. We use the numbers from other countries to help predict what kind of activity we'll see in our state. And when we look at this year's numbers of travel-related cases compared to last year, I mean, we had over 1,000 last year, and this year we're in the 200s. That closely mirrors what we're seeing in terms of a decrease internationally means a decrease in travel-related cases in Florida. So fortunately, we have not seen any ongoing local transmission in our state this year, but we continue to work closely, as I mentioned, with providers in the area, hospital systems, to make sure that folks that present with symptoms that are consistent, that they make sure they get a travel history and look for travel to an area where we know there is still ongoing Zika transmission, so that we continue our testing and are able to identify quickly if we have folks that have travel-related cases. And then as we've done in the past and as we do for all mosquito-borne illnesses, work very closely with our mosquito control districts to go out to areas around where that individual lives and or works and conduct mosquito control and mitigation activities. So we do remain vigilant, but we are hopeful, at least for now, that we will continue to see lower numbers. And in the meantime, as there's ongoing progress towards a potential vaccine and or other treatments, we'll be better prepared next time.
Okay, thank you.
And our next question comes from Travis Bubinik of the Houston Public Media.
Hi, yeah, thanks. Y'all had mentioned that in this report you had, you know, some reactions to, I guess, the post-Harvey preparedness, some lessons learned from Harvey, and I guess I'm just wondering if anybody could talk about some of the highlights on that in this report.
Sure. This is John Auerbach, and I'll mention a few. One was related to the issue of resilience that I mentioned earlier. There is an essay within the report that talks about how important it is to incorporate into emergency preparedness and response, as well as recovery, paying attention to the behavioral health issues that individuals face. The trauma of evacuation, of the loss of a home, of grieving, of confusion, create tremendous health risks for the public. And so we think that that essay highlights a very important message that it is essential that all emergency preparedness efforts do, in fact, pay attention to those particular health needs. Another lesson that was reinforced is pay attention to those members of the public who are most vulnerable and to ensure that there are special arrangements made to assist them or to provide necessary services for them in the event of an emergency. You heard Dr. Remley talk about how important it is that planning include the special needs that children will face in the event of an emergency. But other lessons from the hurricane were that paying attention to the elderly, paying attention to people who have disabilities or have other medical conditions which make them particularly vulnerable is also an essential part of the response. I will say that in general, there was a very positive assessment of the response in both Texas and Florida to the emergencies this year that were related to the hurricanes. In general, indications are that as a result of the expertise in the public health departments and the other responders, there were many fewer health-related emergencies than there would otherwise have been. And so there was a recognition that the strength of the public health departments, the training that they'd had both in responding to other emergencies and in doing training drills themselves throughout the year, paid off very well in terms of the response to the hurricanes.
And it looks like we have time for one final question. That'll come from John Lundy of Duluth News Tribune.
Hello, thank you for responding to my question. And any of you could probably appropriately respond to this. I want to ask about vaccinations and particularly about flu vaccination. Our state contains a robust anti-vaccination minority. And in a season in which media headlines are reporting 10% effectiveness of this season's flu vaccine, how hard of a sell is the flu shot?
So this is Karen Remley. I'll start first because the sell, and I would say the discussion, occurs in every pediatrician's office and pediatric specialist around the country. We know through research that the academies conducted and in the public health sphere that having a trusted provider have that conversation with you about the importance of having a flu shot every year and being able to build up your immunity to the ever-changing flu viruses that come through on a regular basis is crucial to children's health. And we publish policies on how to have that conversation, how to deal with parents who may be who are completely opposed to any vaccination versus parents who really need a thoughtful, careful conversation to do exactly what you're saying, to counteract sometimes the sensationalist news or what people hear from friends or from the internet. So the pediatrician's office is a very trusted place to have that conversation. In addition, our public health colleagues, and I can turn over to Dr. Phillips, work very hard on a community level to both make that vaccine be very available, but to also have those conversations.
Thank you. This is Celeste Velba. I'll add that we've been looking at other ways of communicating the importance from the perspective that it's for protecting our own families, own children, but also thinking about those in our communities who maybe have an immunodeficiency or some other condition where they cannot get a flu vaccine and their immune systems are not as strong. And this idea that we're helping to protect our neighbors and friends and those that maybe are not eligible for a flu vaccine, that's another approach that we're continuing to message, as well as working with health plans and hospital systems that have a large number of covered lives or people that they take care of, where we can start to see large increases and that herd immunity that we hope to see it, and over time we'll see improvements. And it is a challenge dealing with some of the misinformation that is out there, but that's something that I think in public health and in the provider communities broadly that we're working on together.
And at this time, I'd like to turn the conference back over to John Auerbach for any additional or closing remarks.
Thank you very much. In closing, I again want to express appreciation for the support that we've received from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation for Ready or Not, and to remind the people on the call that the full report is available on our website, www.healthyamericans.org. And if you would like any additional information or additional questions arise, please contact our staff, and we'd be more than happy to provide you with that. And with that, thank you all for participating. Thank you, Drs. Remley and Phillip, and to all of those on the call.
And again, this does conclude today's conference, ladies and gentlemen. We appreciate everyone's participation today. You may now disconnect.